trip back to Victoria for all those in navy blue.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. I wish you could see what I can see right now. It's a wonderful picture in front of us, a beautiful day in the UAE. I'm talking to you now just before Australia take on Uzbekistan, so hopefully that's a good result for the national team. You're listening to this after the result, no doubt, and a man that was at the game and a man who's alongside me right now, he's a former Socceroo, in Scott McDonald, and I'm delighted to have the chance to chat to you, Scott, about what you're up to these days and about your career. Thanks for joining us on the Fox Football Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Gubs. It's always a pleasure.
Not bad out here, is it?
No, it's some place, isn't it? It's a paradise within itself, and if this is what winter looks like, you wouldn't mind this all the time, would you?
You spend a fair bit of time in winter because you're still based in Scotland, of course, and it's not much fun over there. So I'm sure you're happy to be here right now in January. But before we get on to your career and how it all started and, of course, your time, you know, at club football at the highest level and in the national team, what are you up to these days? What does Scott McDonald do to keep busy?
Well, something that's been in and around me for a while and a bit of a passion of mine is being within the media. It's not always been easy, obviously, while you're still playing, because some managers, some clubs don't like it. But I've always, you know, tried to do my bits and bobs, you know, within it, whether it be, you know, co-commentating or going on set and doing analysis and stuff like that from games. So I managed to do that a little bit more full on now, which has been great. I've been given the opportunity in Scotland to do so and thoroughly enjoying it.
Fantastic. In terms of the end of your playing career, it seems to me like you almost adopted the Mark Viduka theory, where he said, I never announced when I was going to start playing football. Why would I announce when I quit playing football? Is that how it happened for you, or was it just like a natural end?
Pretty much. I don't like big announcements, and like it's not something to celebrate your retirement, is it? If it's still the case. But I suppose part of me in my mindset is still not retired. I think, you know, I've just been to the gym this morning. I've only had about 3-4 hours kit, but I can't let it go. You know, I think as I got older as well, I'm certainly in a lot better shape than what I was 10 years ago. Do I miss it? I miss bits of it. I don't miss all of it. Some people miss the changing room camaraderie. Sometimes I don't. I'm quite an individual and like my own space at times. Certainly that's the case. I still have a passion for the game and still want to be a part of it in some capacity in the future. But as it is right now, I'm just continuing to concentrate on the media stuff.
Did you get close to coming back to Australia? There were so many rumours of you coming back to the A-League for a stint. What happened? How close did it get?
I was very, very close. And it wasn't up to me in the end, you know. I think there was a lot of media around it when, you know, Tony Popovich was still at Western Sydney Wanderers. They were looking for a striker to go and compete in the Asian Champions League at that period in time. And I was keen as mustard. He tried to get me in, you know, the start of the season. It just never worked out. Motherwell weren't willing to budge. And then in the January, we thought we could get it over the line. And so did I. And it went all the way to the very last, you know, minute of the window. And even then still, you know, Motherwell were threatening relegation and didn't want to let me go. And it was a huge disappointment for me and my family because, you know, Western Sydney were willing to give me a longer term deal, a fresh start, and a great opportunity for me as well to go and ply my trade, you know, within, you know, the A-League and really go and show people, you know, what they've not seen of me. Because, you know, I've had a good career and I would have liked to have shown people, you know, just how good I was.
You certainly did over in Europe over a number of years, unfortunately not as often in the national team, which we'll get to. But where did it all start? That's what I want to know with Scott McDonald. Doveton in Victoria is your hometown. What was it like for you as in terms of playing football as a kid? Was it an obsession or was it something that was a bit of a natural growth?
Well, I think coming from a football-obsessed family, obviously everyone knows that my background is from Scotland as well. Mum and Dad are both from there, from Glasgow, and my dad was a decent footballer, you know, playing Premier League football at that time as well. You know, he immigrated when he was about 15, 16 and played for Doveton. So straight away, where are you going to play? You're going to go play, you know, at Doveton as well. And him and the guy called Stan Webster was my coach, was there. And I just have this vivid memory of, well, I was never allowed to forget it. I walked on, ran onto the pitch I was probably a year younger than everyone else. And these shorts, you've seen the size. Mind you, some would say the shorts are still that big on me. You can't even see my legs anyway. But they were so big and baggy. And everyone was just laughing at me when I come on the pitch. And I didn't know what was going on. Why is everyone laughing? But, you know, it was fantastic. Still have fond memories of, you know, the likes of Dufton. You know, I played at Springvale City for a season. And that was a real successful. That was a real kickstart for me of, you know, my career. Playing under a guy called Danilo Espinosa. Obviously, you know, Vinny Grella played at Springvale City as well. And then I moved to Cranbourne, now Casey Comets. As a youngster, again, Stan Webster was the coach there, playing in the under-16 Super League. And I was doing that well that he was a first-team manager there as well and ended up playing first-team football, you know, at the age of 15. So just a real progression. It happened, you know, very quickly. And from that, Victorian Institute of Sport, Ernie Merrick, and then it evolves. And, you know, I start, Stuart Munro takes a look at me and wants me to go down to Gippsland. And you go to Gippsland and you play in the National League. And then all of a sudden, Les Scheinflug takes a shining as well. And you end up in the under-17 national team fold.
I want to get onto your debut in the NSL as a 15-year-old in a moment, but I can imagine your dad had a big influence on your career, being a footballer himself. What kind of father influence was he? Was he demanding? Did he criticise? Was he encouraging? Because it can often be a tricky one for parents to adopt that strategy.
I think you always think your parents are demanding. So I think the memories of you know, growing up and playing, my dad was quite fair. I didn't always see it that way. My dad was my coach for a good period of time. Up until probably about 10 or 11, he said, right, that's enough. He needs to go and get another voice now, you know, which was, you know, probably a smart choice from my dad to go and hear from other coaches and other aspects rather than just your father all the time. I think he could see the relationship was starting to grain on the both of us. But yeah, there's no question, you know, my father and, you know, my whole family had a huge influence, and it was just something that lived and breathed, you know, within the household.
Were you always a gun? Were you one of those kids that, you know, like in under nines, had the ball, took on seven blokes and scored? Were you always a brilliant player from a young age?
No. Do you know, I was a decent player. I was always quite stocky and physical for my age. I was a centre midfielder when I started playing. And then I was quite quick back then as well. So I ended up playing as a right winger. But it wasn't until when I was at Dufton, we actually raised money and we went and to play two tournaments in Scotland. And from that, I was in a period where it was touch and go on whether I was going to be, you know, getting picked for the Victorian State League, Victorian State teams. I wasn't playing as well. I went to these tournaments abroad, and I actually did really well coming up against, you know, guys a lot bigger, a lot stronger. You know, I always played a year above myself, and we're playing, you know, the likes of Spartak Moscow and teams from Scotland and teams from Ghana and that. And I come back with an air of confidence, a bit of a swagger from going abroad and seeing, you know, how good these players were and what you had to do to get up to that standard, but actually, you know, holding my own a little bit. So when I come back, I think my mindset was, you know, I've done it there and done quite well, so I think I'm better than what's here already. So, and I think I took that on board in a good way, and I went from strength to strength from then on in. And like I said, when I mentioned Springvale there, that was when I first started to play as a centre forward, and that's why I mentioned Danilo Espinosa quite fondly, because he was a guy who gave me that opportunity and, you know, more or less started me to learn my trade, you know, playing as a centre forward.
Fantastic. Can you remember when the penny dropped in terms of you making sacrifices to make it on a personal level? Because I always find that interesting. Like, I mean, I was 13, 14. I mean, I could play the game, but I never thought about ever taking it seriously. I wanted to chase girls and go to the movies. And it always amazes me when I hear sports people say, I started making sacrifices as a teenager, as young as 14, 15. Can you remember when the penny dropped for you?
Yeah, I think when you talk about making sacrifices, I think it's your parents more than anyone that makes those sacrifices. You know, the amount of, you know, traveling that we did, you know, within the whole of Victoria, you know, playing for the Institutes of Sports, the Victorian development squads, you know, going across the other side of the city, you know, on, you know, Tuesdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays. I mean, you know, I was very fortunate to get, I was the youngest that, you know, when I got selected to be in the Victorian Institute of Sport from the age of 15. And from that day onwards, it was full time. You know, you were training, you know, four or five times a week, plus a game. So I think without realizing it, you just enjoyed it that much that you know, it was my full focus. I never really thought about anything else. I suppose when everyone else was doing their bits and bobs and chasing the girls, I still wanted to chase the girls, don't get me wrong, but the full focus was being successful and scoring goals. But even then, did I think I was, you know, going to go abroad and play football and have a successful career the way I did? God, no. You know, I was just concentrating on probably, you know, 1 week at a time and doing well, you know, for what I was doing. But for not one moment did I think I was going to go abroad and play football at such a young age as well.
You made your first team debut at 15 in the NSL. You are the third youngest debutant in NSL history, I can tell you, behind Daniel Watkins, who was 14 and 268 days when he debuted for Parramatta Melita, Peter Raskopoulos, who was 15 and 212 days for Olympic, and you were a few days beyond that. What are your memories of stepping onto the field for Gippsland as a 15-year-old?
It was that long ago. It's 21 years ago almost. Jeez, do you know what? It was amazing. It was an amazing feeling. It was away to Adelaide City at the time. Louis Brain was playing for them at that time as well. It was just, I had a real fond memory of Louis at that point because he was the one that was coming through. We ended up playing in the under-17s together. He was you know, stocky, fast, strong guy as well. But managed to come on, and I think we nicked a draw that night with Gippsland. So I mean, the senior boys were fantastic. The likes of, you know, Manny Godis, you know, Clayton Bell. You know, there was so many. I mean, it was just unbelievable for me. You know, Stuart Munro to bring me in, seeing something in me, and gave me a fantastic opportunity. And from there, you know, the attraction of bringing me into the national team came, so I'm very thankful for that.
Can you remember who you played against? Did they have anything to say to you as a 15-year-old kid up against, no doubt, a robust NSL centre-back?
I do, actually, indeed, because Alex Tobin was playing. So there you go. So, you know, coming up against Alex Tobin, who at that point was so focal in the Australian game, and obviously, you know, in Australian football, a legend. He was some size of a man, I can tell you that. I was only a little boy at the time, so obviously I could, you know, I was physically probably a man, but I was still a boy in the mind. So to come up against someone like that was quite daunting.
Amazing. So you go to that under-17 World Cup, which you mentioned, 1999. Australia finishes as runners-up to Brazil. An amazing achievement. You had Brazil in the group stages, and then you lost to them in the final. I mean, the names in that squad: Josh Kennedy, Wayne Schroy, who people know from the A-League, who was a very talented footballer, Adrian Madashi, Jade North, Jess Van Strutten. What was it about that squad that was so successful?
Just the camaraderie we had, the collectiveness. We managed to spend a lot of time together. I remember before, you know, even that tournament, obviously we had the build-up of qualifying for it, you know, in the Oceania period. The camps were so long. We used to go and train in the likes of, you know, Parramatta, Blacktown, where N-Swiss used to train as well. And honestly, it was just, they just used to drag out. But, you know, Les Scheinflug had us so drilled. And I remember going into the final qualifier against Bahrain to qualify for that World Cup. The games got cancelled. So it meant that we had to come back again and do another sort of 6 weeks camp. It was just relentless. But it actually, in the long term, we were just like a normal team almost, because we'd spent that much time together and we were that well drilled that when we got to finally to the World Cup, you know, we had some amazing journeys. We went to South America on tour as well. Just the experiences at that age, at such a young age as well, the experience of life that we had. But the togetherness, because we were always away from family as well, so all we had was each other. So we all became like brothers, so to speak. And it was just a special time and special memories. And I can still remember a lot of them fondly. And the tournament just went from strength to strength for us. And it was just an amazing achievement. And, you know, to get beaten 8-7 on penalties, you know, it was crushing for us all. You know, I can still remember being in that change room absolutely just drained and gutted and in tears, you know, and seeing my mum after the game and just burst out, you know, in tears. I'm getting emotional now about it, because it was like a dream come true for all us players at that age. Such a, you know, a World Cup, you know, we're Australia. You know, what are we doing in a final against Brazil? You know, and the media attention we had, I think we were getting more media attention than any, you know, senior national team had up until that point. So it was an amazing ride.
Incredible. What about the players you came up against in that tournament? There were a fair few big names that have kicked on.
Yeah, there was. I mean, obviously, Landon Donovan was the player of the tournament. Adriano was in there, DeMarcus Beasley, Hitzelsberger was in there. I think you can name a few more, can't you?
Mikel Arteta, I think, might have been.
Yeah, Mikel Arteta. I mean, there was just so many. And it was obviously, when you go through the actual booklet, I've still got the booklets and that, and you look through some of the players, even with the under 20 tournament, you know, after that, when I went to Argentina, and the one after that, the UAE, like I said, Dani Alves. I mean, it's just amazing to see some of the players that you've actually played against and come up against in the careers that they've had.
What about the Aussie side of things? There's a great story, and it might be a bit of a myth, but it comes from a good source, so I'm going with it, that Franz Beckenbauer, after that game, pulled Wayne Schroy and Adrian Madashi aside after the final and said, I want you to come to Bayern Munich. And Madashi said, I'd love to, but I can't. I've already signed for a Serie A team. He'd signed for Atlanta. And Wayne Schroy said, oh, yeah, thanks, Franz, but I might just head back to Australia. What do you make of that?
I could believe that to be very true. Schroy was horizontal. He was just so laid back. It's unreal. You know, and he was definitely, you know, along with Adrian as well, they were the players that were very much a lot of attention on over that piece and that tournament. And we beat Germany in the tournament. I think it was 2-1. I think Schroy knocked out the goalkeeper, actually. He headbutted the guy off memory. But Schroy was a powerhouse back then. He was a big boy, physical. But he, you know, he had such a experienced head on young shoulders. And I think he... You know, maybe looking back, he could have definitely played in Europe, and it's a bit of a shame he didn't.
So you went to...
He did, didn't he? But, you know, at a higher level, yeah, for me, you know, and a lot more longevity.
You went to Southampton pretty much straight after, or not too long after. Did it pan out from that tournament? And what was that experience like going to Southampton? What did that do for you as a footballer and as a man going into the youth setup there at a Premier League club?
It was tough. You know, it was old school. You didn't get an easy ride. I remember I went over for a week's period, basically to have a look at the place. There was already, if I was happy with it, there was a contract in place. So it was just to have a little look around, train with the boys, get a feel for it. And in the end, it was too good an opportunity to turn down. I remember actually not wanting to go. And if it wasn't for my father, I wouldn't have went. You know, such a young age, to, you know, 16 years of age, to go halfway across the world away from your family. But my dad's convinced my mum, firstly, and myself, look, it's an opportunity of a lifetime. What have you got to lose? If it doesn't work out, you can go home, but don't just dismiss it, because you'll probably regret it for the rest of your life. So I ended up going, and it was the middle of the season when I first went, January 2000 it was. First 6 months were really, really tough. Was homesick desperately. And I remember actually coming back from the week training that I had to coming back for the very first day. And a good friend of mine still, Brian Howard, who was in the youth team together with me, he had a decent career as well. He said to me, just be careful. He goes, some boys want to give you a kick. The manager's already told them to go and kick you. So it was like a reality check of, you know, who's this little Aussie upstart coming over here to take our position? So there was a lot of that used to go on. You know, people didn't like you coming in, taking their places. So I had to deal with that. But it was good. It was good to, you know, for the mindset to go up against that. And you had to go and prove yourself to these people, which I did quickly enough. And managed to bed in after the first 6 months, come back for the next pre-season, and started to really enjoy my time at Southampton.
There were other clubs as well that were keen on you at the time over in England, weren't there?
Yeah, there was. I went to West Ham and Arsenal on trial as well. They had approached and asked me to go there. The feedback I got was, you're as good as probably what we've got, but at those times as well, you didn't just sign, you know, youth forms. If you were a foreign player, more times than not, you were going to sign professional terms. So they just felt, you're as good as what we've got. We could sign you on youth forms, but because you're foreign, we would need to sign you on professional, and we just don't believe that you're right for that position. So, but again, amazing experiences. I had the opportunity to go to Bayer Leverkusen as well. And actually Celtic called up at the very moment, a couple of days before I was about to sign for Southampton, and asked would I come up and have a look and train with them. And in the end, the opportunity to go to Southampton, because it was guaranteed, was just too good to turn down.
There was another young Aussie at Southampton at the time, Jay Lucas, who had massive raps on him. He was like the next big kid coming through. Can you remember being in the academy with Jay or alongside Jay and why it never quite worked out for him?
Yeah, I mean, there's always question marks. It's very difficult when you come over at a young age, and I suppose I went through the period as well, which I imagine Jay would agree with me in terms of you move away from your family, you get this air of independence, so you get to do what you want to an extent. You're earning money that you probably never earned, even though it's small comparisons to what kids get these days. You go off the boil a little bit. So I think, like I said, the first 6 months to a year, it takes you a while to adapt and realize, actually, that I'm here for a reason. And Jay had all the attributes. You know, he was a big physical boy at such a young age. I think he was touted as the next Harry Kewell at one point. But it's very difficult when you're away from your family surroundings and from a confidence perspective. And I just feel that we never seen the best of Jay. He couldn't get up to, you know, the levels that probably he'd shown, you know, when he came on trial.
So you leave Southampton, you go to Motherwell, and then it all clicks for you. Why did it happen so quickly after leaving Southampton that you go to Motherwell and you start scoring straight away? What transpired for that to occur?
Just a manager to give you confidence. I'd been through a lot, obviously made my Premier League debut, thinking, right, I've arrived, this is me now, ready to go on to the next level, I'm going to be a Premier League regular. And in the end, the manager gets sacked, new one comes in, goes for experience, which, rightly so, you're in relegation trouble.
Is that Gordon Strachan?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, he released me in the end. And it was just a case of being a young player and a manager not showing any confidence in you at that moment. It really hit me for six. I was back to square one almost. I'd been on loan at Huddersfield. It was not such a good experience as well. But I say not such a good experience, but actually, when you talk to players or anyone in life, you learn more from your lows than you do certainly your highs, and that was certainly the case. Then I ended up, when I'd finished with Southampton, having to go to Bournemouth. We got a promotion, promised a deal there. Never got one, never heard from the manager. I was waiting for 3, 4, 5 weeks into the pre-season, and I was just sitting in my now wife's home, actually lodging, thinking, right, I think it might be time to go home. And then I got the call to go up to Motherwell through Lou Sticker and an old Carlton player as well, Dave McPherson, who obviously played for Hearts and for Rangers also, to go up and have a trial at Motherwell. And I actually said no. I said I didn't want to. I was going to go home. And it was Dave McPherson who convinced me to do otherwise. He said, well, what you got to lose? You know, it's only going to be a week, and they say no anyway, you can go home. So I thought, right, okay, we'll go up. And went for the first 2-3 days, did exceptionally well, and Terry Butcher, who was the manager at the time, just said, right, we want to sign you. And I was taken aback by it, and from going, you know, hitting the floor from a confidence perspective of not having anyone to believe in you, to that changing within 3 days, just gave me all the confidence I needed. And Terry was an amazing motivator. He was such a good people person, and you know, good around the changing room with his team, and he just allowed me to express myself.
But then Gordon Strachan calls you back for Celtic, and that's where the Scott McDonald story obviously goes to another level. How did that all transpire? What's going through your mind when a club the magnitude of Celtic calls and says, we want you to be our main man up front?
It was an incredible thing. It was a dream come true, because I supported Celtic growing up as a kid as well, and 6 months before that, Rangers had tried to buy me as well, so which I was really keen on, because you want to progress as a player and to the next level, chance to win trophies, play in European football. And then when I got the call, funny enough, I was away with the national team in Hong Kong. We were playing China, I think, in Guangzhou, but based in Hong Kong. I believe Arnie was taking the team at that time, actually. We were in a transitional period. And I got the call from Gordon Strachan to say, you know, do you fancy it? I think you know the question, the answer from there on. And it was just amazing. But, you know, even when I went to Celtic, I wasn't looked upon as a starter. More probably a squad member. And I can remember a few Celtic fans being a bit disgruntled because obviously my history with them. And it was just another sort of squad player. You know, we need to sign, you know, players that are going to play in our first 11. I think they're still saying that now to this day, you know, with players coming in at Celtic. But, you know, that gave me the bit between my teeth, and I knew I had needed to hit the ground running because of obviously the history I had as well. So, but I was never scared or irked the challenge, and certainly stepped up to the plate on that one. And it was just one of those periods in my career where I could have touched anything and it would have turned to gold. That's how it felt. Everything just, especially that first season, just went so spectacularly right.
One goal always comes to mind from you against with Celtic, and that's against AC Milan in the Champions League. Does that one stick out more than any other to you?
I think it does for everyone. They were then the then European champions, you know, the likes of, you know, Maldini, Cafu, Kaká, Inzaghi. I mean, the players they had in that squad were outrageous. Pirlo was playing as well, so you can imagine. So to score the winner against the then European champions was an unbelievable feat. I don't think I'll score many as easy as that, but it's all about right place, right time. And obviously we all know as well that the story afterwards, after scoring the goal, that the whole incident with Dido as well sort of escalated and made it even more...
What was that again? Refresh us.
Well, a fan came on the pitch and sort of tapped him on the shoulder, and Dido had made out he'd been punched more or less and was rolling all over the place trying to get the game abandoned, because he knew obviously that was it was time up. So, and we were all quite worried and concerned actually, because UEFA were looking at it, and we were worried that we were going to obviously get the points deducted and maybe have a stadium ban, this, that, the next. But thankfully it was only a fine, and to be fair, the guy only brushed his shoulder. It wasn't worth the way Dido went down. But yeah, there's so many special memories playing at Celtic, and certainly that one is one of the big ones.
What's it like being a hero to the fans at a club of that magnitude that is so unique in world football? Because, okay, Rangers are coming back now, but they dominate so much. What's it like being in that environment when you start to become the main man? Because from the outside, it seems like it almost seems like you're a cricketer in India, that kind of situation.
Well, it is. I mean, you can compare it to that. It's a certain pressure cooker, that's for sure. And it's like being at like one of the top four clubs in England, you know, and the demand and the pressures on you. We call it the goldfish bowl because, you know, Glasgow, the west of Scotland, such a small place. You know, it's hard to get about. You more or less need to go in hiding. So sometimes it could be a bit daunting. And you know, we're talking about Scott Brown maybe moving to Australia, and he's had 10, 11 years of it. You can see why he would like a little bit of a change out of the pressure cooker. And, you know, when Rangers are obviously competing with you as well, and it just never goes away, you know, from week to week, because you have to answer all the questions all the time, and you're front and back page news every week as well. But that was something that I absolutely loved. You know, some players can fall by the wayside with it. You know, I was one that always loved the pressure and performed my best football under those sorts of pressures. And I felt when I left Celtic, that was something that sort of left me as well. It was something that I was pining for, you know, once I left to go to Middlesbrough.
There's the pressure, but there's also the adulation of being a Celtic star. I'm sure that opens up a lot of doors in life.
Yeah, it certainly does. Even to this day, the way, you know, as an ex-player, you get looked after, it certainly has its perks, you know, in the right ways. They always look after you, and you know, Glasgow's an amazing place for that, and partially probably one of the reasons, you know, I'm still living there. You know, I've made so many great friends over the period.
Your dad's a Motherwell fan, is that right?
No, my dad's a Celtic
fan. Yeah. Sorry. So there's that one season where you were going for the league or whatever, and your dad, you're up against your dad, who supported Celtic. Was it with Motherwell that you almost won the league? I remember that story about a conflict with your father over who he supported and who you were playing for.
What it was actually my father-in-law, actually, believe it or not. He was at the game. He's a Celtic fan as well. All my mum's side are Rangers and all my dad's side's Celtic. So we played Celtic in the last game of the season when I was at Motherwell, the infamous game in 2005. And Celtic were winning the game up until the very last minute of the football match. And if they won it, then they won the league. It came down to the very last game. And there I was to ruin that moment for them in the last kick of the game, and ended up scoring two. So I've never lived that down even to this day. And there's not a day that goes by within, you know, walking down the street or anywhere in Scotland that doesn't get mentioned to me. And it's a difficult one for me to sort of accept or take at times, because I'm a Celtic fan as well. I played for Celtic, so there's a history there, and it's usually more times than not Rangers fans that are actually coming up to you and saying good things about you, you know, when they should be saying bad things, and it's actually Celtic fans that are saying bad things about you. So it's a weird one for me, but something that will I'll always be remembered for, you know, rightly or wrongly, good or bad.
An odd situation, that's for sure. Right, the Socceroos. You knew this was coming.
Yeah.
How do you reflect now? I'm sure it was a dream playing for your national team, but you never scored in 26 appearances as a striker. How do you reflect now on your time with Australia?
I loved it. I'm disappointed. It's probably the one thing that that irks me within my whole career itself. Just not being successful. And do you know what? I'd still be sitting here now if I'd only scored one goal and not been happy. So, you know, I didn't score any as it was. Look, I'm not the type of guy to sit here and make excuses throughout the period. And I don't really want to, because what's by the by. But I'm going to anyway, aren't I? Yeah, you're sitting here, so you're going to ask me the question. So I've got to answer. Look, it was a difficult one because I came through the golden generation, so to speak. You know, I just come into the national team fold after the 2006 success. So many great players. I mean, Mark Viduka had just more or less retired. I managed to play a little bit with Mark, but you still had the likes of Harry Kewell, then Tim Cahill come through as well. Josh Kennedy was doing so well. And the way we always played, we only played realistically with one up top. That was a slow build-up. You know, the Dutch philosophy was possession, keep the ball. And I was used to playing, you know, big man, small man, British football, you know, get it forward quick but with quality. Let's get it right. It's not long ball stuff. And we didn't really necessarily do that with the national team. And it was hard for me. I suppose when you're not in the team constantly all the time, it was hard to feel a part of it, so to speak, because you're going from your club side where you're doing ever so well, you're scoring every week, and you're sort of you're not the main man anymore. Let's put that right. There's some really good players here, and you know, I just felt like I never got a proper decent run of games in a row to actually, you know, be successful with the national team and playing with different partners all the time. But you know, people say, well, other people could do it. Why couldn't you? So I think as well, at that period in my career, I'd never played up front on my own a lot. So I was still learning. Obviously, if you ask me to play that role now, you're far more experienced. You can do it well. At that period, I probably just wasn't the right guy to play that lone role. And the way football's gone, I'd probably be more a number 10 now than what I would be a number 9 anyway. But yeah, look, it's disappointing. And not to say that my performance, I didn't think my performances were ever bad, you know, in a national team shirt. It was just that for one reason or another, you could probably count on one hand, I think, the real good opportunities, and I can still see them in my mind, in my memory, the ones I probably should have scored, but there were few and far between, and it was just weird. I mean, it used to really gripe on me every time coming into the national team, the same question all the time, getting asked, is this going to be the day? And in the end, playing for the national team just wasn't enjoyable. Obviously, after the disappointment of when you were at your peaks as well, not going to the 2010 World Cup for reasons only, you know, Pim will know, being part of the whole build up, the qualification, and then at the very last minute, you know, getting your knees chopped away from you. That was a difficult one for me to take. And after that, even coming back into camps, I never felt fully Australian anymore. It ripped a part of me out of me that I never quite got back from that day.
Interesting to listen to. I mean, you speak about it weighing on you. Can you remember, like, it actually just the talk around it when it came to chances that were presented, ones that you would bury for Celtic, it actually starting to enter your mind in that split second when the chance presented itself?
Definitely. Yeah, looking back, you know, I was anxious. Probably didn't think that at the time. But even in training, you were anxious. You're always trying to impress too much. Trying to more or less stand up and show and believe that you're there and you're at the levels of everyone else there. And I found it difficult. It was almost like you felt at times playing for Australia just wasn't right for me. And that's how it got, you know, mentally. I'll be honest with you, even at points I said to myself, I probably should have played for Scotland, because the type of style of football that Scotland played probably would have suited me better. Now, I would never turn my back on my country, but in my mind, that was what I was thinking. Have I made the right choice career-wise? Because the type of football that we're playing, I'm just not suited to it. It's as simple as that.
I remember times, though, when you were suited to it. On the odd occasion where Pim played two up front, I remember a game in Brisbane against Qatar, and the game, I was there covering it. It's memorable to me because the game was delayed because of a deluge before the game, which delayed it for about half an hour. But Australia won 4-0, and you played up front with Josh Kennedy. To quote Mike Bassett, England manager, on the rare occasion Australia played 4-4 effing 2. Yeah. And you two were fantastic together. And you didn't score. I think Emerton scored two. I think Josh might have scored one, and Cahill scored one. But the combination play of you two up front was dynamic. I mean, you must look back and lament that you never got more opportunities like that.
Yeah, I suppose so. Again, it goes back to the manager wanting to play a certain shape. And you feel as well, especially those home games playing against, you know, the Asian teams at home, you're going to dominate the games. You're going to have more of the possession. But you know, the Dutch style and the tactic that he wanted to play was, and it was implemented, and it was done well, and under Gus as well, it worked. So you can see why they stuck with it. But you're right, you know, playing in a game like that was thoroughly enjoyable, you know, because again, it was the big man, small man. But then you had the likes of, you know, Harry Kewell to come back in. So, you know, who was going to play? And even Josh found himself sometimes not playing as well. Timmy would go up one, you know, every now and again as well. So it was never a foregone conclusion, right, I'm coming in the national team and I'm going to play with Josh Kennedy, or I'm going to play with that one. Because even with playing with Tim was enjoyable. I felt I had a decent partnership with Tim as well. But it just never happened for me. It was always itty-bitty rather than being a focal point for the national team. And I think that frustrated me at times.
So after that, you left Celtic eventually, and you went to Middlesbrough, and then you went to Millwall. You've been quoted as saying that your life spiralled out of control a little bit when you were playing it at Millwall. You maybe weren't applying yourself professionally. Can you expand on that, and what happened during that period after leaving Celtic and you're not part of the national team anymore?
Yeah, I think more from a mental point of view, I never went AWOL and on the lash or anything like that. I was probably the opposite of that. I was probably too intense. Even my teammates would say that I was falling out with people, falling out with managers. And I was, yeah, just not in a good place. I think I was heavily frustrated with how my career was going, and I wanted to put it right. And I felt that going to Millwall was the last, very, very last opportunity, right? I'd been at Middlesbrough. I did reasonably okay, but we never had the success that was expected over the four-year period. And basically, I was on lockdown because from a financial point of view, I was well looked after, and there was no one willing to go and match what I was on at Middlesbrough, so I had to stick it out a little bit. So I felt a little bit trapped within that moment. Finally, I was able to escape that period and move on, and maybe jumped a little bit too quickly, because again, I felt, right, Millwall playing 4-4-2, which was said we were going to do. Steve Morrison, you know, obviously played Premier League football. He had come back in. I thought, he looks the type of perfect guy that I'm going to play my best football off. Let's talk about us wanting to get balls in the box. So it's all going to work well. And realistically, it just went from bad to worse. You know, Steve Lomas was an ex-West Ham manager, you know, played for West Ham. So the rivalry there, you know, Millwall-West Ham, was just really intense. So he was never going to get a long time if it didn't start well. Certainly didn't. Then Ian Holloway came in, and Ian's an interesting character, to say the least. And I learned a hell of a lot off him, from a tactical point of view, as a person. But he liked to get into the psyche of players and break you down a little bit as well, which I wasn't really enjoying, almost to the point of breaking you and then wanting to build you back up as this new person. And I just wasn't into it. I could see through it almost. And I wasn't happy about it, and we had a few fallouts through it because I just wasn't willing to play ball. And I ended up playing centre mid a lot of my period at Millwall, Hence, I think you look at my record, I didn't score many goals. But what I look back from that and what I take from it is that I learned a hell of a lot about the game itself, playing in different positions, and actually got better as a technical footballer through that period. But it wasn't the period I wanted. And I ended up going back to Motherwell after that because I needed to enjoy my football again. I was in a dark place within football, where I wanted to be. I was no longer part of national team setups. I wasn't scoring goals, and everyone watching from afar is going, oh, well, he's failing. You know, I think as a footballer, when you've had success as well, you've got a huge ego. So your ego sometimes gets in the way. Only now, when you get older, you realise that it's a stupid thing. And you shouldn't really care what other people think, but I think at times it certainly affected me throughout that period, especially. And you know, it's a point where I wish things could have went a lot better. And you know, there's no question in my mind. Even now, when you're 35, I don't think any footballer would disagree with this. You always feel that you should be playing at the highest level, and you could still do it.
It's fascinating to listen to. Even before then, though, when you were at your peak, there was always a rumour going around, or a rumour, that's not the right expression, but word going around that Scott McDonald was not one afraid to open his mouth to share his views. And once, I guess, you went through a period of not scoring for the Socceroos, you were the easy player to leave out because you wouldn't cause, the problems would be gone then. Do you think back now and think I should have bit my tongue a bit more or not?
I think throughout my whole career I probably should have done that, but that's not me. The person I am isn't that person. And I think it got me to a certain extent to where I got to in the first and foremost. But yeah, look, I think this day and age as well, you grow up and you look back and say, yeah, probably could have done a few things a little bit differently. But within the national team setup, I never had any fights or fallouts with anyone particularly. Well, not from my end anyhow. I wasn't shy in telling some of the senior players, you know, when I arrived that, you know, no uncertain terms I'm going to be bullied or told what to do. I'm here on merit, you know, and there's 20 of us here because we're all here on merit, not because you're a bigger player than me. So did I have any fallouts with that? No, but I could be difficult, there's no question. I still can be quite prickly, but that's just my character. But when people get to know me for who I really am, then they know I'm not that. I'm just an intense character, especially when I play the game.
I think anyone listening to this would say that you're a character that Australian football could use because you've got a lot of wisdom to share and a lot of experience. Would you like to get involved directly in Australian football one day?
Absolutely. You know, there's no question, Gabs, that I'm hugely disappointed I never got the opportunity to come home and play. It's irked me a little bit the last couple of years that no one wanted to take a nibble. Question marks raised, maybe because people think I flirted with the situation a lot and wasn't serious about coming home, which certainly wasn't the case. I would have loved the opportunity, but it never happened. But you know, in the future, definitely, I'm certainly one that wants to be a manager in the future. I've done all my coaching badges. I'm just about to hopefully start my pro license, UEFA pro license as well. And it's just getting the foot in the door now and getting on the coaching map, which I'm close to doing back in Scotland as well. And if in the future that I can possibly come home and you know, work within the game, it's certainly something I would consider. But there's no question I have ambitions as well to manage within Europe. I think you know, spoke to Harry recently, who's done ever so well and still has ambitions to do that as well. And I think it's something that a lot of it's disappointed me actually, and I'm sure it's disappointed a lot of Australian public that, especially from that golden generation, there's not enough players from that era coaching and giving back their knowledge to the Australian game. And I think the FFA needs to look at that as well, and possibly look to bring in, you know, some of these people on board, you know, for their experiences. Now that we have this new board, hopefully they can lead by example and start to, you know, bring these people in that can help the national team, but can also help the Australian game.
Spot on. Although the day that we're doing this podcast, they've got some issues with the Matildas, which are probably taking precedence for them. Hopefully the Socceroos have cured that when we watch them a little bit later on. three easy questions that I love doing with former players. Everyone does. Obvious questions, but very interesting ones always. Best player you played with, best player you played against, best coach you had.
Best player, Shinsuke Nakamura. Obviously, we know him well from playing against him, you know, for Japan. But my, you know, 2-3 years at Celtic with him, what a player. I mean, he could have played at the very highest level. Still playing now at 40 in Japan. Mind you, he's still got some way to go to beat that 51-year-old, isn't he, in Japan? But, yeah. But he was... He just had an amazing talent to... He could keep the ball in the tightest situations. He was such slight-framed, but he could wiggle his way out of just anything. And we all know about his set-piece taking as well. And for a guy that never spoke English, he could find the ball anywhere on the pitch. He just had an intelligent brain that you just pick up pockets and just find spaces. So it definitely, without question, he was the best player to play with.
Best against? I mean, it has to be someone you played regularly against. Like, if you played against Messi in a charity game, that wouldn't count for 5 minutes. But, you know, someone you played against, you know, that actually in terms of one-on-one battles for a striker.
Yeah, I mean, I go back to my most difficult opponent, and probably because of the team itself. I mean, Diego Milito was unbelievable, like, because he wasn't the biggest guy. He was only about 5'11". But he was one of those intelligent ones. And they're the hardest centre-halves to play against because... They've actually got more mobility. So they nick in front of you. They get their foot in between your legs, this, that, and next. And they were always... I just couldn't do anything right that night. I'd come short. He would nick it. I'd go long. He'd drop. I rarely touched the ball. So most difficult opponent would be him. But if we're talking probably week in, week out... Probably I'd have to go back to, you know, my Scotland days and probably either Stephen Presley, who then played at Celtic. He was so experienced, and for a centre half, he didn't half love a dive. You know, he'd suck you in and fall over the ball all the time. He used to frustrate me as a centre forward. Well, it should be me doing it, not him. You know, so he was a very clever, intelligent defender, very old school, and probably Bobo Baldé was just because he was quite daunting. You know. Big guy, but I love the challenge of playing against the bigger physical man, that's for sure. So probably those two opponents.
Best manager you had?
I think without question, you ask any player, you know, they're always going to go where their best football is, you know, under who they play that under. And certainly for me, you know, Gordon Strachan, the relationship I have with Gordon to this day is phenomenal, especially where we first started from at Southampton, and then obviously, you know, played my best football under him at Celtic and then took me to Middlesbrough as well. So still have a real, you know, special affiliation with him.
Lovely. Now, I've given you a bit of a challenge to name your best 11 of players that you played with. So this is across club football, and there were many a club, and for Australia as well. Your best 11 from the man between the sticks to the men up front.
Yeah, well, man in the sticks has to be the one and only Mark Schwarzer. Just an unbelievable professional, unbelievable goalkeeper to play for as long as he did. But not just that, just the man he was. I love being in his company. he always used to give me stick about because of my height. He still does now, git. But he was just so hard to play against. I remember doing. He didn't do my confidence any good. That's for sure. Playing in a national team, trying to, you know, finish against him. That's for sure. But I just see the career he had as well, and what a stalwart for the national team, and just an amazing goalkeeper. So he's my goalie. My left back would be Wayne Bridge. I played with him at Southampton. Went on to even bigger and better things, playing for England, Chelsea. Just an unbelievable athlete. Really good guy as well. Jonathan Woodgate, one of my centre-halves. You know, what do you say about the guy? You know, he was unfortunate with the injuries that he had, but I've never seen a guy be able to move his feet so quickly, and you would chop him, you would twist him, and he'd still be there, you know. And even when he was younger, a lot younger, he was rapid as well, and he would have had far more England caps if it hadn't been for his injuries. Now the centre-half would be Klaus Lundekvam, from Southampton. He was actually my roommate when I played in the first team there, and do you know what? He's more a player of this era than what he was back then. He had that old school sort of tough mentality, but what a player. You know, he could come out, glide with a ball, drive with it, slip a pass. You know, he was ahead of his years, you know, and certainly now if he was playing in this era, you know, there'd be clubs, you know, of a higher level looking at him. So he was just a great guy as well and a great leader. And I had to fit him in at right back, obviously started his career there, Lucas Neal. Lucas, fantastic guy, you know, great captain, leader of the national team, but an exceptional footballer, you know, and the way he was able to adapt himself from right back to later on in his career to go at centre half and still be, you know, a fantastic, you know, player for the national team and in the Premier League, you know, at West Ham and at Blackburn. You know, he gets in my 11 as well. And
the midfield?
Yeah, well, we talked about Nakamura already, so he's in there. Aidan McGeady was another guy I played with at Celtic. What an exceptional talent he is and still is to this day. He's now at Sunderland, you know, playing in League One, which I cannot believe.
I'm watching Sunderland Till I Die right now on Netflix, so I can believe it when you watch what goes on it at that place. But he was in that docker.
Yeah, he's another one that speaks his mind, that's for sure. And we're still good friends to this day, but he could have been anything he wanted to be. He chose to go to Russia, though, from Celtic, and he had a real successful four-year period from there, and then Everton. Never quite worked out for him, but certainly, you know, one to get you off your seat, so he's in there as well. The two-man midfield would be, I'd have to say, Scott Brown. Scott Brown was, at that point, he was a box-to-box midfielder. He was getting touted as the new Paul Gascoigne, and rightly so. You know, he was a talented boy, great leader, just a guy that you would want in there, you know, digging away, you know, holding now, especially in front of your back four. And then another guy who's tough as nails as well, a guy called Barry Robson, who I played with at Celtic and at Middlesbrough as well. Yeah. Again, I'd probably say an underrated player. Never really reached the peak of his powers till probably hit 30 and above, and without question he was our best player at Middlesbrough for a good 2-3 year period. Up top, this is very difficult, but I've gone with Matt Letizia.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, Letiz, Le God, as we call him, down on the south coast. I played a lot of football with him because he was at the tether end of his career, so he played a lot of reserve team football at that point, and he got me really fit because he never used to like running. But
he was not going to run in the reserves if he never ran for the first team.
No, he certainly wasn't. But honestly, the things he used to do with a football, and like, you gave him a split 2 seconds on the edge of the box, it would be in the top corner. He was that good. I just remember watching him and like doing shooting like at the end of training, and it's just like it was top corner after top corner. And I'll never forget last game at the Dell, and he was so unfit at the time, was never playing, always injured, and he managed to get himself fit just near the end of the season, and we were playing Arsenal at home that last game, and he come on, and it was 2-2, it was just set up, it was unreal, it was just like a film, and he come on, and he swiveled with his wrong foot, his left foot, and put it in the top bin, and we ended up winning the game 3-2. And I just remember sitting in the crowd because I wasn't involved in the squad that day, and just it was unbelievable. I don't think I've jumped as high as that ever in my career. So he's in there. This was a tough one for me because I played with that many good strikers throughout my career. I was going to say Mark Viduka because he's my idol. I only played with Mark a couple of times though, so I don't think it's fair that I picked him, you know, and it's a toss-up between Timmy and Harry. But I think, sorry, Timmy, I'm going to go with Harry. I think Harry, at the peak of his powers, what a technically gifted player. Certainly the best talent out with Bresch as well, I think, that we've ever had, you know. I mean, Dukes as well, but certainly the golden boy, certainly when I was growing up as well, and he was fantastic to play with, and the things he could do, and it was just disappointing for him and for everyone else, you know, especially when he went to Liverpool and onwards, that, you know, he was plagued by injuries, because, you know, there's no question he could have been one of the very, very top players in England.
I listened to a golf podcast, and they always ask the golfers, how different do you think your career would have been if it wasn't for Tiger Woods? As an Australian coming through, how different do you think your career might have been if it wasn't for what Harry Keel did?
Yeah, I think it would have been different. I think you look at players like him who made the jump at such a very young age, you know, and I did exactly the same. So I think you do look at that and go, well, if it was good enough for him, it was good enough for me, you know. And at that time, we only had the National League then, and there wasn't the finance of what the kids have got now back home to stay at home. So we had to go abroad and try and make a career of it to make anything of being a professional footballer. And I think it had its plus points that to compare to what we have now a little bit until the development side gets better within the Australian game. I know that there is a, you know, an under 20 league now or a youth league. I think the youth development side, the academy structures need to, they're getting in place. They need to be a lot better. But I think as well, when players now are getting to the early sort of 18, 19, 20 years of age, they're on social media, they're playing for, you know, big clubs in the A-League, they're around all their mates. Where's the desire then when they're on good money as well, or they think they're on good money, to actually then go and, right, I'm going to go and, you know, knock my pan in and go abroad, you know? And I think sometimes we're missing that, and that's why possibly success-wise we haven't got the players that are playing in Europe as what there was previous. Because we have got such a good league now. So it works, swings and roundabouts, isn't it, in a certain way. And obviously with the money that's been flying around in Asia and us being part of that now has not helped that situation as well. But I think you can only look at grassroots, and I'm amazed to see the likes of the AIS, all the institutes of sports now. I know they're all government funded. They're all gone now. You know, I don't know if they would survive anyhow because there's money in the game. So players and young players' heads and families' heads get turned by a couple of dollars rather than the development of you know, the footballer itself at such a young age. So hopefully the infrastructure can continue to get better within the A-League, and they can you know, spend the money to get these youth academies set up right.
Hopefully there are more Scott McDonalds running around in Doveton with big dreams that are able to realise them like you were able to. I mentioned Harry Kuehl before. Obviously there was Craig Johnston and Farina that came before him, but at your time, in terms of paving the way in Europe, he was obviously a big factor. Scott McDonald, thanks so much. That was awesome to listen to. You have an amazing story and a lot to give the game, and we hope you can give it back to Australian football in the future. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Gobbs. Thanks for having me.